It's a great pleasure to be here and to have a chance to talk this morning. I'm simply going to talk. I prefer doing it that way. I find I can focus better on what I'm saying and on you, the audience, if I do that rather than use PowerPoint. So I hope that's going to work for you. And I'm going to propose a cognitive theory of religion and a particular kind of cognitive theory involving two different systems. It seems to me that some dual system theory is essential if we're going to capture within cognitive theory the characteristics of religion and spirituality. Now, I think I need to add a disclaimer about what I'm doing in proposing a cognitive theory of religion. I recognize that cognition is not merely rationalist or intellectualist, and if I was proposing a narrowly intellectualist theory of religion, you would immediately see that that was inadequate. So a cognitive theory of religion includes both explicit and implicit aspects of religion. It includes non-conscious as well as conscious aspects of cognition. So I'm taking a broad view of what's involved in cognition. And it's perhaps rather like cognitive theories of emotion, which have been increasingly fashionable in recent years. Such theories don't assume a narrowly intellectualist view of emotion, but use the broad framework of cognitive theory to understand what's going on in emotional processing. Now, as I said, I want to propose a dual-level, dual-system cognitive theory. And in doing so, it seems to me best, rather than developing a theory specifically for religion, to make use of one or more theories which have established their credibility in other areas. And I'm going to draw on two main theories this morning, neither of which have been applied to religion much elsewhere, but or in the first place, but which I think have promising applications to religion. One is a purely cognitive theory, developed by my former colleague in Cambridge, Philip Barnard, the Interacting Cognitive Subsystems, ICS for short, Interacting Cognitive Subsystems. I'm also going to be drawing on a model of cognition based on the two hemispheres of the brain, and here I'm going to be particularly drawing on a very interesting book published in 2009 by Ian McGilchrist called The Master and His Emissary. So these are the two cognitive theories I'm going to be keeping in play. I think they converge and agree at many points, though in some ways the McGilchrist theory, which is grounded in the physical brain, I think takes things further and is more specific than the ICS theory of Philip Barnard, though I don't think it contradicts Barnard's theory at any point. Let me say something first about ICS, Interacting Cognitive Subsystems. It sets out a general theory of the cognitive architecture in terms of nine distinct subsystems. I'm not going to take you through all of those. It's unnecessary for my purposes. But there are two of these subsystems that are especially important from the point of view of religion. The two central ones, the two subsystems that constitute the central engine of cognition, as Barnard likes to call it. One, the propositional subsystem. It's the easiest to explain because the propositional subsystem uses essentially a linguistic code. The meanings of the propositional subsystem can be expressed in language relatively easily. It's open to articulation. propositional thinking proceeds in a linear way, as language does. The other central subsystem is the implicational subsystem, which is a little more difficult to explain, though it's important because I want to suggest that it's particularly essential in religion. It's more implicit, more intuitive. And I think religion may be one of the areas where the implicit meanings of the implicational subsystem are particularly important. It's one significant feature of the implicational system that it has direct links to body states. That's not true of the propositional subsystem. Implicational meanings, as I've said, are more tacit and intuitive. They're more schematic. They integrate a variety of different things together in a single, rather compressed encoding. So there's a contrast between the dense, schematic, implicit coding of the implicational system and the more articulate, linear encoding of the propositional system. I want to bring this into dialogue with the model that of arising from two hemispheres of the brain, particularly in the way that McGilchrist has expanded it in his recent and brilliant book. And there is a rough analogy between the left brain, I'm assuming left brain dominance, but of course that is not true for 100% of people, the left brain and the propositional system. As everyone knows, the left brain is the one where language is particularly encoded. So there's an obvious link there. Between that, there's a linkage there. Also between the more tacit cognitive processes of the right brain and the implicational subsystem in Barnard's model. So with those two models in mind, I want now to look at various aspects of religion and to see how they map onto them. I could say something about the evolution of religion, but that's quite a long story, and unless you ask me about it in discussion, I think I'm going to move over that and come to religion in children. And the advantage of looking at religion in children as opposed to the evolution of religion is that we have some empirical data to guide us. It would be in line with what's known about cognitive development in children from Piaget onwards to postulate that the propositional system comes into operation first. That the implicational system comes into operation first, at least in the rudimentary form. And the propositional system, this more articulate system, develops more slowly and perhaps doesn't fully come into operation until the Piagetian stages of formal operations. There's much evidence, as I'm sure you know, that children's religious understanding, like their intellectual understanding of almost everything else, follows a developmental path from the concrete to the formal. So I'm linking that to the more gradual development of the propositional system. But the ability to understand religious meanings, at least intuitively, occurs much earlier than the capacity to explain them. And interestingly, also, there is research from various people, Taminen and Rebecca Nye, that spiritual experience in young children is quite common and powerful, at least if spiritual experience is used in a broad sense, and that it is common for children to have spiritual experiences before they're able to do much intellectual articulation of religion. So I'm suggesting that those spiritual experiences of children, Taminen's children were seven, they are linked to the operation of this tacit implicational subsystem, whereas the ability to articulate religious meanings, that comes along a little later, 11, 13, something like that, and that is linked to the more gradual development of the propositional system. Let me say something briefly about conversion. From the earliest days, psychology has been much occupied with conversion, though there's been widespread recognition of the diversity of conversion experiences. Some seem to be primarily intellectual, though not very many. More of them are social or moral kinds of conversion. And there have been a number of intriguing examples of people who've long adhered intellectually to atheism, but who nevertheless have a powerful religious experience late in life. And that seems to set up a striking disjunction between an articulate atheism that has all the hallmarks of the propositional system and a latent religious understanding which is intertwined with a religious experience, but which is difficult to articulate. I think relatively few conversions arise from an intellectual source. Most conversions seem to arise intuitively from moral or social reasons and then need to be cashed out later. So we're dealing here with a sequence that is rather like the one that we encounter in children who have intuitive spiritual experiences before they're able to articulate them. In the majority of conversions, people come intuitively to a position of faith and then undertake the intellectual articulation of that as a secondary stage. It's interesting also to link this to Fowler's model of faith development. His first few stages 1 to 3, seem to represent a transition from concrete to abstract religious thought, rather like those that are set out by Piaget and other people who've looked at the development of religion in Piagetian terms. Stage 4 is not really a cognitive stage at all, but more concerned with growing independence from religious authority. But interestingly, stage 5 seems to be a cognitive stage of a new kind. It focuses on paradox and on deeper aspects of self, and it suggests a re-emphasis on the dense, highly general code of the implicational system. The status of Fowler's theory has been much discussed, whether it has strong empirical support or whether it simply reflects a set of values about religious maturity. And I'm not convinced that we're dealing in this theory with an empirically demonstrable developmental sequence. But we are certainly dealing or encountering Fowler's assumption that the more intuitive, paradoxical meanings of the implicational system represent a superior stage of religion to those that are involved with the earlier stages of development. Let me turn now to saying something about meditation and the mystical states of consciousness associated with it. They provide another fruitful application of this two systems model of religious cognition. Excuse me. There are, of course, many different approaches to meditation coming from different religious traditions, but I think they have enough in common to be treated in a general way for the time being within the psychology of religion. John Teasdale, who collaborated with Philip Barnard on interacting cognitive subsystems, has already offered an account of mindfulness within this framework. The normal human state of affairs is that multiple cognitive processes are proceeding simultaneously. Multitasking is the norm. But Teasdale suggests that mindfulness involves suspending that normal multitasking in favor of a more coordinated use of multiple cognitive subsystems, so that only one thing is happening at a time. I would be inclined to present that in a slightly different way and suggest that activity in many of the cognitive subsystems is much reduced, that they're almost switched off. And it's a feature of the meditational state, I think, that people go as far as they can to switching off processing in their peripheral subsystems so that the central engine of cognition can have their full attention. But then, as I've said, we have these two subsystems in the central engine of cognition. And in most meditation techniques, there is an attempt to switch off the more articulate propositional system as well. And people use various techniques for suspending the normal flow of articulate cognition, the chatter of the mind, as meditation teachers normally call it, so there can be free rein for the more intuitive cognitive meanings of the implicational system. One interesting feature of meditation is the state of ineffability that people describe. Most mystics who have powerful religious experiences have said they are ineffable. It's one of the classic hallmarks of mystical experience that William James describes, that you're not able to put your mystical experiences into words adequately. One of the interesting things here is that the ineffability of mystical experience doesn't stop mystics writing lengthy books about their mystical experiences. They do. So it is clearly not impossible to write about these ineffable experiences. What they are doing, I think, in saying these experiences are ineffable is saying that they have to translate them into a different kind of code in order to express them. That the cognitive code in which mystical experiences initially occur is not one that can be directly articulated. a process of translation needs to go on before they can be articulated, and there is clearly, subjectively, a sense of loss about that translation. You can do the translation, but you're left with the feeling that when you have, you no longer have the original experience in the form that was powerful to you. And I suggest that this is exactly what you would expect on a two-system model of cognition. That the more intuitive, implicational system is where mystical experiences arise, but they can't be directly articulated from there. In order to be articulated, they need to be translated into the different code of the propositional system. They can be, but when you've done that, you're no longer dealing with the same kind of experience. And I can couch this as well in terms of the two hemispheres model that McGilchrist has articulated so well, that mystical experiences would arise in the non-linguistic code of the right brain, but then they would have to be fed across into the more linguistic code of the left brain before they can be articulated. And though that is perfectly possible, you're then dealing with a different kind of cognition from the one you started with. I think these two-system models also provide a helpful way of formulating the distinctive features of different kinds of Christianity. Let me first say something about Protestantism, which at first glance seems to be very much word-based, to be a very articulate form of religion. On the face of things, therefore, word-based Protestantism seems to prioritize the propositional subsystem, or the left brain. However, things may not be as clear-cut as that suggests, because the way in which language is used in religion is often distinctive and unusual. Language can be used in religious contexts in a way that is less dry and rationalistic than normal. Rather, in religion, it's used in a way that is evocative and poetic and speaks to the heart. So in terms of this ICS model, it seems as though even word-based forms of religion like Protestantism are using language in a way that's unusually closely tied to the richer code of the implicational subsystem. And the condensed intuitive meanings of that subsystem can give rise to a stream of words or symbols that are moving and poetic and speak to and arise from what religious thinkers call the heart. Sacramental religion. Surprisingly, sacramental religion has been rather less investigated in the psychology of religion than fundamentalist or charismatic religion. But there have, of course, been interesting reflections on ritual. And I suggest the key point here is that ritual can be used in different ways in religion, just as words can be used in religion in ways that are either dry or evocative. Sometimes, as Freud pointed out a long time ago, ritual can be an obsessional defense against anxiety. But alternatively, as some neo-Freudians have pointed out, Erikson, Preusser, ritual can be evocative and provide a space in which mystery is sensed, and important cognitive processing is done, albeit in a rather inarticulate way. From my ICS model, it seems as though sacramental Christianity provides a rich opportunity for implicational, intuitive religion. It emphasizes visual and other sensory experience, and also bodily action and participation. And remember that there are direct links from body state into implicational, intuitive cognition, but not into the more propositional cognition. And the visual impact of liturgy is particularly striking. It uses a rich range of sensory experience, smells and bells, in order to heighten sensory impact. And ritual actions, such as genuflecting, crossing yourself, also involve the limb system. So it looks as though the forms of religious encoding incurring in sacramental religion are connected to a much broader range of body experiences and expressions. But it would be a mistake to see sacramental religion as abandoning the propositional system completely. And it's noteworthy that the Catholic tradition has always insisted on an integration of word and sacrament within the Mass. Non-propositional meanings are preceded by and embedded within a more propositional context. I could say something here about a charismatic phenomenon such as glossolalia, speaking in tongues, but I'll do so very briefly. My main suggestion here would be that when people are speaking in tongues, though you have an articulation, people are not articulating the kind of propositional meanings which are what normally occur when people speak. You have speech without propositional meanings. But it's not that what people are doing in glossolalia is meaningless. People have a clear, general, intuitive sense of what they mean to be doing. Usually it is the praise of God. And so I'd want to suggest that what's happening is that people are going from a rather general, intuitive, implicational meaning, the praise of God, and almost switching off the propositional subsystem so that this general sense, intention of the praise of God emerges in speech sounds without being translated into linear propositional thought in the way that normally happens when people are speaking. It's a very unusual mode of speech production, and interesting that the cognitive architecture is capable of it. And the only analogy that occurs to me in everyday life is with baby talk. When people are talking to a baby, they often, in a somewhat similar way, no longer express propositional meanings. They no longer utter sentences. The general meaning of what they're saying is clear. Isn't this a lovely baby? But they're expressing this in speech sounds which are not sentences and which don't convey any linear propositional meanings. So I'd want to suggest that the two subsystems of ICS are being used in a rather unusual way when people are engaged in speaking in tongues. Let me move now and say a little bit more about the other model with which I've been touching base in the course of what I've said so far, the brain lateralization model. One of the distinctive things about primates, about humans among primates, is that the two halves of our brain are more distinct than in any other related species. And there are two points here. One is that our two hemispheres are more different and more specialized than in any other related primate. And the other is that there is less physical relationship between the two hemispheres in humans than in other primates. You might expect that evolution would have led to greater integration at an anatomical level between the two hemispheres, but in fact it has proceeded in the opposite direction. Just a moment. So humans, more than any other related species, really have two alternative brains which can operate with a greater degree of independence than in any other related species. One of the fascinating things about McGilchrist's book is that he links this to cultural history over the last few hundred years and suggests that we've been moving towards a culture that has been increasingly left brain dominated. There have been some ebb and flow in that process, but that, he argues, and I think convincingly, has been the general trend. The left hemisphere deals with pieces of information in isolation, whereas the right hemisphere deals with information as a whole. The left hemisphere specializes in linear analytic processing, whereas the right hemisphere proceeds with parallel processing in a way that's more closely integrated with sense perception, body states, and emotion. The left brain is focused on what it already knows, filtering new information through its preformed schemas, whereas the right brain is more open to the other, to what it does not know. Anatomically, the left brain is more tightly encapsulated within itself, whereas the right brain has much better connection with the rest of the body than the left brain does. So this neurologically based model of McGilchrist is in many ways supports the model that Barnard proposed on the basis at the level of cognitive architecture. But I think McGilchrist takes things further in some interesting ways. He links these two processing systems to emotional tone. The predominant mood of the intuitive right hemisphere is towards melancholia. It has a rather negative, depressive mood state, whereas the mood state of the more articulate linguistic left brain is more optimistic, confident, even arrogant. He also has an interesting view of asymmetry in the way that these two subsystems can cooperate. It's the general inclination of the intuitive right brain to want to work in cooperation with its more articulate other hemisphere. But it's the inclination of the left brain to want to do things independently and not to collaborate with its more intuitive other hemisphere. So that produces an interesting asymmetry, so that if there is going to be integration at all, it generally needs to proceed from the intuitive right brain in the first place. if you start from the more linguistic left brain, there is little inclination from there to get into collaboration. McGilchrist also maps this onto cultural history in an interesting way, and is concerned about the predominance of left-brain thinking in our culture, and warns in a rather apocalyptic way that he thinks that is very dangerous and has gone too far. But the escape routes that might lead us back towards more use of the intuitive right brain seem to be blocked off. And the two main escape routes that he mentions are art and religion. Interesting from our point of view that he should see religion as one escape route, but everything, even art and religion, can be done in different ways by both hemispheres. They're done in different ways. Both hemispheres can do religion, but they do religion differently, just as both hemispheres can do language and mathematics, but in different ways and to different extents. The more complex a task is, the more it will involve using a symphony of processing arising from many different parts of the brain. What does left hemisphere religion look like? And I think it can be illustrated in relation to studies of fundamentalism and radicalization. Since the upsurge of fundamentalism, sociologists have noted the instrumental use of modern technology to use and spread the messages of the so-called backward-looking fundamentalisms around the globe. But if you look carefully, you see that there is actually a considerable use of modern methods in this fundamentalism. Fundamentalism presents itself as a return to earlier authentic forms of religion, but actually it makes considerable use of modern methods. Another interesting feature is that this black and white mentality of the left brain exists within Christian fundamentalists, stressing the literal accuracy of the Bible. And that is linked into our scientific culture. Though there is often on the face of things a conflict between what fundamentalist religion is saying and what science is saying, in fact, I think it can be argued that fundamentalism is using a philosophy of knowledge that is rather like the logical positivism with which science is often involved. So in fundamentalism, we see a modernist trend to elevate word-based, abstract, rational knowing over the more implicit, symbolic knowing that would occur in many other kinds of religion. So even though I've argued that there is something rather distinctively religious about the kind of encoding that you find in the intuitive implicational system and in the right brain, that's not the only system that can do religion. You can have a kind of religion that proceeds from the more articulate subsystem, which I'm mapping onto the left brain. But it is in some ways, I think, a perversion of religion and not one that carries the richness that religion has traditionally had and the benefits that it is capable of. And McGilchrist is wanting to argue the general advantages of our culture connecting back with the right hemisphere, with the more implicational subsystem, and religion as a way of doing that. it seems to me that if that's to happen, then we need to find a way of doing religion that connects better with that way of processing than the fundamentalist mode of religion towards which our culture is increasingly moving. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for this thought-provoking talk, which we'll now hear the response to by a psychologist, Kevin Ladd. Unfortunately, we are not going to have the theological response to it, but there are theologians among you, and I hope you will be able to provide some remarks during the panel discussion. So Kevin Ladd is associate professor of psychology at Indiana University, has been very active in the scientific committee towards preparing this conference. So look forward to listen to your response.
I think we're live. Yes, good. Well, thank you again very much, Fraser, for the presentation. I will move relatively rapidly through some series of questions here that hopefully will set us up for a bit of discussion when it comes time. My main question here, of course, is what has happened to our bodies in the midst of all of this? The first question that I think of, maybe I didn't turn it on. There we go. Sorry about that. The first question that I think of that comes to mind as I listen to Fraser's talk is about the primacy of cognition. What is it that's going on here with this idea of acquiring, representing, and communicating knowledge? We think of knowledge as this very strong cognitive sort of a process. And I wonder to myself, am I a cognitive hedgehog in some way? Der Igel, I believe, is the German word, yes? A hedgehog is one of these interesting animals that has a singular kind of response. Everything that happens to the hedgehog, it fundamentally curls up and protects itself. And I wonder if, as a human being, I operate in a similar way, that everything that I do is about some sort of knowledge that is in somehow processed at a level of my brain. Am I a cognitive hedgehog? What if my brain hemispheres lacked communication? As he was speaking of at the very end here, this idea of the crosstalk between the hemispheres, and I think it would be interesting if you might be able to comment on, for instance, split-brain patients and their experience of religiosity and spirituality, and what happens if the hemispheres can no longer chat back and forth. What happens if we turn the entire system on its head and we take what Teasdale and Barnard have talked about and we have some sort of an emotional theory of cognition? In other words, the way the body structures the thoughts as opposed to the way the thoughts, whether implicit and explicit, structure what is happening in terms of our emotionality. And is there something that can be said that takes us in an opposing direction here? I also think about the distinctiveness in this paradigm of religiosity or of spirituality more broadly. Is it the key component of religion that it always has to act on some kind of knowledge? Again, going back to this underlying idea of cognition, whether implicit or explicit. To what extent is religion or spirituality necessarily some kind of an interpretive process that lays on top of our experience some sort of an understanding? To what extent must religion be this active sort of a control orientation that tells us how to experience what it is that's going on around us? What if belief systems or religion are not, in fact, about meaning and control? What if meaning and control are higher order cognitive sort of luxuries? Things that we must have time and space in order to reflect upon, in order to create. Because meaning and control are things that happen not in an instant, but rather as a result of some sort of extended consideration. And in the heat of any given moment, meaning and control are not the first things that our faith or our belief systems offer to us. I wonder if perhaps meaning and control are instead more luxurious than what it is that happens immediately with our faith in terms of lower order emotional kind of structure, more visceral sorts of responses that our belief systems actually respond to in a way that is far more basic even than an implicit form of cognition. I think here in terms of the explosion of the paradox within religious systems that takes us outside of just the Christian tradition and talks about many different traditions. For instance, the Japanese koan, what is the sound of one hand clapping? When are two drops of water not two drops? When you add them together and they become a single drop. What happens with these sort of puzzles? What happens on the theological front of the topic of theodicy? Is the process of theodicy or of trying to justify a good conception of a God in the face of bad events, is theodicy more about finding some kind of structure? I do not know what this event means, but I know that God is taking care of it. Is that meaning or is that structure? I think it might be more about structure. It tells me how things operate without telling me why. These higher order cognitive structures of paradox, etc. On the role of the body then, I wonder, With this theory of Teasdale and Barnard, have we gone back to some of the older forms, the earliest forms of monism within the field of psychology, where we think fundamentally the only thing that the body is good for is to bring information to the brain, whether this be at an implicit or an explicit level? What happens when language and intuition fall apart? What happens when language and intuition are wrong? Would faith matter if we remove the brain? Is there anything like religion or spiritual experience left if we get rid of the brain and just have the body left? In the context of this particular conference, is it okay then to end life support when the brain is no longer seen to be functioning? Is there nothing human left at all? Are we only brains? What happens with regard to post-death rituals? Why is it that we treat the body in certain ways and that we have these expanded rituals about bodies after the brain is gone, if we fundamentally believe that religion is about the brain? Why not just simply dismember the body? There's a beautiful scene at the beginning of a movie of Tibet, and they're on the mountain and these wonderful birds are flying overhead, and then you realize what is happening in the midst of the chanting is the fact that at the death of this person, the priests are up there hacking the body apart and throwing the pieces out so that the vultures can come and eat the body. This is not something that would happen in a Western tradition. And so I wonder if the emphasis on cognition and implicit and explicit sort of understanding is primarily a formulation of conception of religion and spirituality that is more of a Western idea about the brain supremacy, as opposed to an Eastern sort of an approach that might give more supremacy to the body even without the brain. On the nature of experience, I wonder if cognition cognition, this explicit cognition, actually, as Fraser mentioned, restricts our experience because we tend to intellectualize the experience. We remove the bodily, visceral kinds of components. And I wonder if the implicit approach actually facilitates experience very much, or if it still represents some form of cognition that impedes experience in a way that does not happen if we had an idea of a mindless body. We can think of mindless bodies as still having experience if you are familiar, for instance, my grandmother used to have live chickens that were part of the evening meal. And so when it was time for dinner, she would grab the chicken by the neck, spin it around, the head would pop off. Does the chicken die immediately? No, the chicken continues to run. What about at the time of death, and many of you have been present at the moment of death, the body, the mind is clearly gone at that point, and yet the body continues to go a little bit longer, and we hear the rattle of death that for first people, interns and clergy who are first present at the time of death can be very startled by this, that the body is dead, and then suddenly it breathes, it makes sound, and it's very startling. Mindless bodies, there's still some sort of experience going on or not? What about this notion of mindfulness? Is there a comparative kind of an understanding that we might think of that is bodyfulness? So instead of thinking about the ineffable as something that becomes quantified, in some way we try to bring that to the surface, even though it is ostensibly ineffable, I wonder about this idea that translation can only happen when it's no longer necessary. Is it the case that the only time we can talk about an ineffable experience is when we have in some way already made it cognitive? In that way, we begin to immediately get rid of the basic quality of the ineffable. Is it possible for us then to exhume the body from a cognitive sort of an approach? Can we think about the gestalt of this in a way that is an emergence, that these pieces are added together not just with the implicit and explicit forms of knowledge, but is it the fact, perhaps, that religion that we've talked about much at this conference, is religion about the implicit and explicit formulations that take place in our brains? And perhaps spirituality then, this other word that we have been working upon, is spirituality about the ineffable, that which is truly beyond expression and that which we do not even care to try to express? Maybe the most profound of mystics are those who do not ever write. And so I will leave those for a panel discussion, multiple questions, hopefully, that will stir your imagination and help us to think creatively as we come to our discussion later on. Thank you very much.